Thank you, Dean Jeffries, for that warm and generous introduction and for choosing me for this wonderful honor. And thank you, Mr. Shannon, for having given me the time, the freedom to pursue my interests, even when, as in today, those interests are a little off the beaten path. And thank you all for showing up today. This is very gratifying. Over the 28 years that I've been at the law school, as the dean mentioned, I've collaborated on law and social science with Larry Walker and now with Larry and Greg Mitchell, and on mental health law with Richard Bonney. And I've enjoyed those collaborations enormously. They have been incredibly fulfilling and gratifying to me. But the project I want to talk about today, I admit, was more fun than work from the get-go. I became interested a while ago in two questions that might be of particular interest to a law school audience. First, how satisfied are lawyers with their chosen careers? And second, how satisfied are lawyers in their lives more generally? As I explore those two questions with you today, I'll rely heavily on an empirical study that I conducted with Jeffrey Swanson, a statistician at Duke University. We followed the UVA Law School class of 1990, better known to those in this room as Darryl Brown's class, from the time they began law school here 20 years ago to the time they walked down the lawn 17 years ago, up until the fall of this academic year. Before I can tell you about that study, though, I have to briefly situate it within two different research traditions: the large body of literature on lawyers' career satisfaction, and the much more recent literature on life satisfaction, sometimes called subjective well-being, or more prosaically, happiness. And I have to tell you about how I came to be studying the class of 1990. First, career satisfaction. There are actually two literatures on lawyers' career satisfaction, and they produce such disparate results that one has to wonder sometimes if they're studying the same phenomenon. The first literature is vast, popular, anecdotal, and much better known to both lawyers and non-lawyers alike. In this body of work, lawyers are claimed to be, in the words of Patrick Schultz, a practicing lawyer, then a law professor, and now a federal judge, unhappy, unhealthy, and unethical. Compared to those in other professions, lawyers are said to be prone to depression, anxiety, alcoholism, drug abuse, physical illness, and divorce. One study, for example, claims to have demonstrated that over 10% of all lawyers in North Carolina, quote, consider taking their own lives at least once per month. Okay? No, no, no. The fatal methodological flaw that characterizes the popular literature in the lay and legal press is the extremely low response rate that generally characterizes the data collection. For example, one recent and embarrassing, quote, survey by the National Law Journal, modestly titled Profession Sinking, had a response rate of 11%. Now, if this were a random 11%, the sample might be perfectly adequate for generalizing to the population of lawyers. But there is no reason to believe that the 11% of the people who volunteer to participate in these haphazard questionnaires, there's every reason to think that they drastically overrepresent the miserable wing of the legal profession. I think there's very little to be learned from the sensationalized Geraldo-type "the sky is falling" research projects. The other body of research on the career satisfaction of lawyers derives from traditional social science methods. This careful academic work finds that lawyers are not nearly as dissatisfied in their jobs as the media would have us believe. Indeed, the most valid, well-designed studies with the highest response rate, such as the work of John Heintz on Chicago lawyers and the ongoing and remarkable After the JD project by Ronit Donovitzer and her colleagues, supported by the American Bar Foundation and the Law School Admission Council, following over 5,000 young lawyers throughout the early years of their career. These studies have produced no support that lawyers as a group are at the ends of their ropes, either figuratively or literally. In this research, lawyers' career satisfaction seems very much like the career satisfaction of people in other professional groups. Many people love their jobs, most people like their jobs well enough, and some people desperately wish they were doing something else. That's all I think you need to know in background and research on lawyers' career satisfaction. The second and much more recent tradition in which I want to situate my study is research on people's satisfaction, not with their jobs, but with their lives more generally and perhaps more profoundly. As Daniel Kahneman, the psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in economics, has pointed out, economists have a long-standing fondness for studying people's revealed preferences for what they want in life. That is, for allowing people to vote with their feet or with their wallets for what makes them happy, rather than looking to what people say they do in their lives or what they claim to like and dislike. A well-known problem for the economic model, however, is that people often make choices that bear a strange relationship to their ostensible well-being. A by now enormous literature in behavioral economics and in cognitive psychology finds that people often make blatantly inconsistent choices, fail to learn much, if anything, from their experience, are oddly reluctant to make obviously beneficial trades, and depart from the standard model of the rational economic agent in many other ways. To the extent that it's true that people display very bounded rationality when it comes to maximizing their own utility, then perhaps the preferences they reveal by their choices only imperfectly reflect their true preferences, and perhaps self-reports of people's experience of well-being can play a useful, although no doubt limited, role in understanding whether people are getting what they want out of life. But otherwise, it might be heuristically productive to let people vote with their words, as well as with their feet and their wallets, in measuring their well-being. The study of subjective well-being, or life satisfaction, is now a booming area of research. Like any new field, it has its share of true believers and more than a few outright flakes. But it has, at best, produced some very interesting findings. Just a few of them. The first finding has got to be a study that got the field started and is still the single most cited research project. That study looked at the subjective well-being of two groups of people, one consisting of people who had just won a major lottery and the other of people who, through tragic accidents, had become paraplegic. As one would expect, when questioned soon after the drawing or after the accident, the lottery winners were euphoric and the people with paraplegia were despondent. When questioned again only 2 years later, however, and amazingly, the life satisfaction of both groups was pretty much back to the level it was before the lottery or before the accident. Not quite down or up to the same levels, but very close. People seem to adapt to the circumstances of their lives, even extraordinarily good or bad circumstances, to a much greater extent and much more quickly than many people would have thought possible. Second, money. The correlation between income and self-reports of life satisfaction is surprisingly low. In the United States, self-reported life satisfaction increases with household income until that household income reaches approximately $50,000 a year. After that, there is virtually no relationship between how much money your household income is and how happy you are. Sophie Tucker was clearly right when she said, "I've been rich and I've been poor, rich is better." But given this research, she also would have been right if she said, "I've been rich and I've been middle class, it's pretty much a wash." Right. No question, it's bad to be poor. But if you make more than $50,000, it doesn't seem to make much difference. This finding holds for nations as well as for individuals. China, for example, has experienced huge gains in real income in the past decades, and yet surveys in China show no change at all in average levels of life satisfaction. Third, there may be a strong genetic component to life satisfaction. among twins reared apart, the correlation between ratings of life satisfaction among identical twins, twins who share all the same genes, is significantly higher than the correlation between ratings of life satisfaction among fraternal twins, twins who share only half the same genes. This is the standard way of testing for heritability. Indeed, the correlation between ratings of life satisfaction among identical twins is about the same as the correlation for clearly biological variables such as height. Fourth, while genes play some role in life satisfaction, there's a large cultural component as well. For example, average life satisfaction ratings in Scandinavian countries are substantially higher than they are in Japan, despite similar levels of industrialization and standards of living. Finally, life satisfaction has a significant developmental component. Specifically, the life satisfaction of parents seems to plummet when their children become teenagers and to rise precipitously beginning the day those teenagers wave goodbye to go to college or to join the workforce. A finding which I'm sure some of you will find just shocking. Right. As can be expected in any new field of research, there are many methodological controversies about the way to measure subjective well-being. The gold standard of measurement is called experience sampling, where you give people a programmed Palm Pilot that beeps at random times of the day and asks people both what they're doing right now and the emotions they're experiencing at that moment. This method has the advantage of getting people's online experience of well-being. You don't have to rely on people's often faulty memories. On the other hand, it's cumbersome to get people to do this for any extended period of time. After the 10th beep, the main emotion that they're feeling seems to be annoyance. Right. Right. The way to measure subjective well-being that's used most often is to ask people to report not on how they're feeling at this moment, but rather to ask them to reflect on their lives more generally and to answer a standard set of questions on how satisfied they are. This is the way I measured life satisfaction in my study. So that's the brief version of research on life satisfaction in which I want to situate this project. Finally, a few words about the intellectual history of the class of 1990. When I first got to the law school, I taught one course that was mostly first-year students and another course that was mostly third-year students. I was struck by what a different experience teaching these two courses was for me. Almost all the first-year students were jumping up and down, raising their hands, call on me, call on me. It was a wonderful course to teach. You know what's coming. In contrast, right, many, but not all, of the third-year students never raised their hands and, in fact, spent the entire last half of every class looking at the clock, which they evidently thought was too slow. This was not a wonderful experience. I began to wonder why some third-year students kept on trucking, maintaining their original enthusiasm throughout law school, while other students gave up the ghost by the end of their first year and just warmed their seats. I eventually came up with a hypothesis that I thought might predict which students remain the energizer bunnies and which students begin to blend into the woodwork. The hypothesis had to do with a theory called explanatory style. It was developed by a psychologist you may have heard of named Martin Seligman. The theory concerns how people explain the causes of negative events to themselves. According to this theory, there are basically two types of people, optimists and pessimists. Optimists will tell themselves that the cause of some problem in their life is external to themselves, that the cause is limited to this particular problem, and that the cause is transitory and will soon pass. Pessimists, on the other hand, attribute the cause of a problem in their lives to themselves personally, believe that that cause affects not just this problem, but many other problems as well, and think that the cause will likely be around for the duration. By the 1980s, there were a large number of published studies concluding that, on many different tasks, optimists do better. For example, door-to-door salespeople get many doors slammed in their face. This is no doubt a negative event. The optimistic salesperson, when this happens, explains the event by saying, "That person, the door slammer, has a problem. I might not have gotten this sale, but at least other things in my life are going well. I'll bet I'll be luckier when I knock on the next door." In contrast, the pessimistic salesperson, when a door is slammed, explains the event by saying, "I must do something wrong. Nothing in my life is going well. The next person will probably slam the door in my face, too." Perhaps not surprisingly, in a number of empirical studies, it turns out that optimistic salespeople sell way more widgets than do pessimistic salespeople. They persevere in the face of adversity rather than throwing in the towel and becoming despondent. The same results, optimists do better, had been found in many different career choices, in many different kinds of athletics, and in many different aspects of academic life, including undergraduate performance. But it had never been studied among law students. I figured that I had found some low-hanging fruit. Right. I reasoned that, to a law student, getting a bad grade, say a C, is a negative event. This was in the day, by the way, when the law school had a mandatory 3.0 mean in all courses. I had previously done a survey for a faculty committee that had found, under this 3.0 mean, the average student graduated from the law school with two C grades on his or her transcript. Given the stringent admission standards at the law school, most students had never had a C associated with their name before. And now they had two of them. This had to have been a blow. So I confidently hypothesized that what distinguished those students who continued to be engaged in the classroom during their third year from those who mentally checked out was explanatory style. For the optimist, I thought that a C would be explained as, "The professor gave a dumb exam." Great. At least I hit a home run in softball. My next grade is probably going to be an A. For the pessimist, on the other hand, I thought that a C grade would be taken as a sign of personal failure, be put in the context of just having struck out at softball or otherwise, and seen as an omen of more bad grades to come. Being an academic, I wanted to test this theory. I chose one law school class, the class of 1990, and gave them a standard instrument to assess explanatory style during their orientation to law school in 1987. Then, with their permission, of course, I followed the members of that class during their 3 years at the law school, looking at their grades, how engaged they were in the classroom as rated by their professors, whether they were on a law review, how they did in moot court, and many, many other factors. After graduation in 1990, I couldn't wait to look at the results. The good news is that there was indeed a relationship between explanatory style and performance in law school. The bad news is that that relationship was the exact opposite of the one I had predicted. Right. In law school, it turns out, pessimists do better than optimists. The only study ever to find that. Right. The students who scored as pessimists during law school orientation, for example, got significantly higher grades throughout law school and were significantly more likely to make the executive board or the law review than were students who scored as optimists during orientation. I remember when I saw these results saying to myself, but out loud, "Thank God for tenure." Right. I ultimately concluded that in the law, the concept of pessimism might be better termed prudence. When you think about it, a lawyer's job is to worry about negative events happening, to take negative events in a client's life or in a client's business personally, as it were. Just like no one wants an optimistic doctor to tell them that the spot on their x-ray is just a fly speck, don't worry about it. Nobody wants a lawyer to look at a contract and say, "Relax, what are they going to do if you can't make the payments? Foreclose?" Right. The song, "Don't Worry, Be Happy," was not written by a lawyer. Right. In any event, I published an article with Martin Seligman and a graduate student of his, Jason Satterfield, on the study I did on the class of 1990, and I completely put it out of my mind until last year when Jody Krause and I decided to teach a seminar together called Legal Careers and Life Satisfaction, bringing together some of the work that I mentioned before. I was visiting at NYU and thinking about a syllabus for this seminar with Jody, and I thought I'd assign them to read the by now old explanatory style study. I reread the study, and the more I thought back on that research, the more I began to wonder what all those students on which I had already gathered all that information were doing now. And more to the point, preparing the seminar, I began to wonder how satisfied are they in their careers and in their lives more generally. As soon as I got back from New York, I ran to the storage closet near my office and pulled a file drawer that I hadn't opened in 17 years, and lo and behold, the data were still there on floppy disks, 5 1/4 inch floppy disks, remember, disks that actually flopped when you shook them, right? I had lunch with Dean Jeffries and talked about doing a follow-up study on the class of 1990, and he responded with enthusiasm. I told him that, to be completely honest, there was one big problem with doing a long-term study like the one I was proposing, and that is simply finding people years after you first study them. The dean looked at me quizzically and said, well, that shouldn't be an issue. The Law School Foundation knows where they all are. And with that insight, I was off. Right. First, let me acknowledgments. I want to thank Dean Merrill for supporting the original study in 1987 and Al Turnbull for helping me out enormously in conducting that study in the class of 1990. I want to thank again Dean Jeffries for being so supportive of the current research, including, indeed, especially, paying for it. I want to thank Jody Krause for inviting me to teach the seminar with him and for sharing his many insights on this subject, and the seminar members for the critique that was very helpful to me in this work. I want to thank Michelle Morris for keeping me up to the minute on research on legal careers and life satisfaction. I want to thank Lisa Atwell of the Law School Foundation for giving me the current addresses of all but 6 members of the class of 1990. I would like to thank Kent Olson for finding all 6 of those people. One woman got married and divorced 3 times and changed her last name each time. Kent found her. Right. Property records. So you can run, but you cannot hide at this lesson here. And I want to thank Tom Guderbach and especially Deborah Rexrode from the UVA Center for Survey Research. They did a terrific job in actually conducting this study. So, here is the class of 1990 study, right? The methodology, it's a longitudinal design. I followed people, and then 17 years later, the benefit of this, alternatively, you can just talk to people now and ask them to remember back what it was like. The problem with that is people's memories. The standard finding in psychology is that 85% of everybody graduating from college remembers being in the top half of the class. Right? I didn't have to worry about that. I knew what their grades were before, right? I had a representative sample. There are 360 living graduates of the class of 1990. 3 people from the class had died in the intervening 17 years, right? 260 people responded, 155 men and 105 women, so the sample is 60% men, 40% women. The response rate was 72%, which I believe is the single highest response rate of any longitudinal study like this ever done at any other law school, which says, I think, a lot about the loyalty people feel from the school. People were given a UVA law school refrigerator magnet. As honest to God truth, I have a few left over if you want any for participating in the survey. Right. And we gave them validated measures, standard measures, of both career satisfaction and life satisfaction, as you will see. Right. I got in 1987, among the information that I got in this study, we got people's gender, we got people's race, although the percentage of African Americans in this sample was too low to analyze that data separately. their age, their social class, their mother and father's educational level, indices of pre-law school achievement or ability, depending on how you want to construe that, their LSAT score, their undergraduate GPA, the admission index, which is these two things together in a formula, and their explanatory style scores, whether they scored as optimist or pessimist, again, during orientation, before law school started. Right. I looked during law school at their grades. I got their three-year GPA. Class participation, everybody's participation was ranked as low, medium, or high by one of their professors during the third year of law school. Right. I looked at law review membership, the Virginia Law Review, or their more specialized law reviews. Right. The variables I measured 17 years later looked at their first employment after law school, the type and size of their first employment, how long they were there, the number of job changes they had. And I asked about their current employment, whether it's full-time, part-time, or not employed, the kind of setting they're in, how long they've been there, the type of law they practice, the hours that they worked last week, and their annual compensation. I also asked for background information on a self-reporting of their health, how much, what their household income was, whether they were currently married or partnered, right? The work status of their spouse or partner, and the number of children they had. Then I gave the measures of satisfaction with the decision to become a lawyer and to go to UVA, satisfaction with their current job, and satisfaction with life. At the end, I left an open section saying, is there anything that you want to say, any reflections that you have on your life or on your career, and any advice that you wanted to give to current law students? I put this in thinking that no one would respond to anything, because it takes time to do that. As it happened, everybody had something to say, and I think their comments were actually quite useful. What I want to do is present the results in terms of five questions. What's happened in people's personal lives? Have their careers began after law school? What they're doing in their jobs now? How satisfied people are with their careers, and how satisfied they are with their lives more generally? First, what's happened in the intervening 17 years? Well, have a mean age of 43 with a standard deviation of 3, so two-thirds of the sample is between 40 and 46. 58% say their health is excellent, 38% good, 4% fair, and 1% poor. Of the people, or are you currently married or partnered? 87% of the men and 79% of the women are currently married or partnered 17 years after law school. People who are divorced and not remarried or partnered, 2% of the men and 9% of the women. Never married or partners, 9% of the men and 11% of the women. In terms of people who were ever divorced, 10% of the men had been divorced at least once. 18% of the women had been divorced at least once. This is a chart, of, a graph of graduates, the spouse, your spouse or partner's employment status by graduates' gender. So, for example, of women who were currently married or partnered, right, their husband worked full-time 77% of the time. Their husbands worked full-time. Of men who are currently married or partnered, their wives worked full-time 24% of the time. Of men who were married or partners, their wives were not, did not work outside the home at all, about 58% of the time, and women, their husbands, did not work outside the home 11% of the time, with here people working part-time between 12 and 18%. So you can see people have very, very different situations at home, and this may have a lot of impact for the kind of support that they have in terms of their own careers. Right. Number of children, 1, 2, 4, or more. You can see 18 to 21% of the men and women have no kids, right? Which means 80% of the people have at least one child, 10% of the women, 15% of the men have one, 39, 40% have two, 25% of the women have three, 19% of the men. Four or more children is 5% of the women and 10% of the men. Household income, pre-tax income for the previous year, the median income was $250,000 a year. The lower quartile, the bottom 25%, household income of $150,000 or less. The top quarter had an income of $450,000 a year or more. The lowest 10% made $75,000 or less. The highest 10% made $750,000 or more. Of the 260 responding graduates, 15 had a household income of $1 million or more in the year. Right. How did people's careers begin after law school? Well, virtually everybody was employed after law school. Everybody except one person, right? Looking at private law firms, right? Firms with 100 or more lawyers, small private law firms, fewer than 100 lawyers, the government, somebody in business or financial industry, and other, a broad category, including legal services, prosecutor, defense attorney, public interest lawyers, and academia. You see 58% of people who graduated from the law school in 1990 started off in a large firm, 24% in a small firm, and much smaller numbers in other kinds of occupations, right? Still at their first, 15% of the graduates are still at the job they started in the fall of 1990, meaning 85% of the people changed their jobs. People remained at their first employer a median of 3 years. They changed jobs on average twice between graduation and now. It's different in some settings. If you look at still at their first job, if they started at a large law firm in Washington, D.C. or New York, in 1990, 37 men and 20 women started off in a firm of more than 100 in Washington and New York. Last fall, who's still at that firm? 4 men or 11% and none of the women. So there are some settings where lots and lots of people leave, right? What are people doing in their careers now? Well, here's graduates' current employment status by gender. Of the male graduates, 99% are currently employed full-time. Of the women graduates, 61% are currently employed full-time. About 24% of the women were employed part-time, and the part-time median of 20 hours a week was part-time. None of the men were employed part-time. Of the women, 15% of the women were not employed outside the home, and one of the males was not employed outside the home. Unfortunately, if there's one slide you're going to remember when this is over, it's going to be this one. Right. The percent of men and women graduates employed full-time by the number of children that they have. Right. Here is the men. Varies between 96 and 100% of the men employed. The correlation between number of children, 1, 2, 3, and 4 or more, and working full-time is zero for the men. Whereas... yeah. For the women, mind you, women with no children, it's the same as the men. There's no difference. It's exactly no difference. It's, I think, 97%. With one child, it goes down to 70%, 2 to 66, 3 to 20, and 0 to 4 or more, right? So 4, I mean, that's 4 more is a lot of kids. But there is, and this is like, right. But there's a lot. The correlation, for women, the correlation between working full-time and number of children is 0.5, right? The type of employment setting that they're currently in, now large firms, only 28% of the people are in large firms, 18% of the people in small firms, 15% of the people in government, 24% business or financial, and 16% in these other category. If you look at the change between the type of organization where people were first employed and were currently employed, you see it's large private law firms went from 58% to 28%. That's where people move from large private law firms. Small firms lost a little. State, federal, local government gained a little bit. The big gain is in business. This is people who move to work for a client, who work in-house. It's gone from about 3% to about 25%. So that's the big gain, as well as this other category, which is a wide, as I say, variety of public service or academic kind of careers. People were with their first, had been with their current employer a median of 7 years. A quarter of the people had been with their current employer 12 years or more. A quarter had been with their current employer 3 years or less. So people are still moving around 17 years after graduation. 75% of the people say that they are practicing as a lawyer in their current job, and a quarter of the people say they are not. The kinds of jobs, if not, they're either owning their own business, they're CEOs, academics, academic administrators, international bankers, or investment bankers. So a quarter of the people are doing something that, in their words, is outside regular legal practice. In terms of if they're practicing as a lawyer, what are they doing? 18% civil litigation, 16% corporate, 6% real estate and employment law, 5% criminal, intellectual property, securities, and environmental law. And this great big category, 34% of the people, there were fewer than 5% of the people in any one job, people who did family law, for example, tax law, and a large variety of other categories fell in there. So there was certainly no one type of law that predominated. The mean number of hours worked last week for graduates who said they were working full-time, and this did not count the five people who said they were on vacation last week. Large private law firms, mean hours per week, men 53 hours a week. On average, women were 56 hours a week. Small private firms, 48 and 46 hours. Government, 45 and 42. Business, about 48, 49. The other thing, 51 hours men, 45 hours women. So a slight but not huge gender difference. And in some fields, like private law firms, a gender difference with women working more. Right? If you ask how many people said they worked 60 hours or more last week, this is worked, not billed. Private law firms, again, another shock, right, 25% of the men and the women in private firms said they worked more than 60 hours last week. You can see in these other areas from 0 to 5 and a couple, 10% of men, a slight working more hours by men, but not a statistically significant number, right. This is what hurts. Mean annual compensation, including salary and any bonuses if applicable. Large private firms, by far the highest, men made on average $536,000 a year. Women made $473,000. Small firms, women $286,000, men $257,000. Government, men $138,000, women $103,000. Business or financial, men $374,000, women $217,000. Other, men $268,000, women $119,000. If you look at the percentage that women make as a function of what men make, women make 88% of what men make in large firms, 90% of what men make in small firms, 75% in the government, 58% in business and financial, and 44% of what men make in these other settings. So you might say, you should say, why is that? So we did, Jeffrey Swanson, a multiple regression model trying to predict annual compensation. We did several different models, but in any one model you can only include so many variables. In this model, we included gender, admission index, right, your explanatory style, optimistic or pessimistic, your law school GPA, your ratings of your health, whether you're married or partnered, the number of children you have at home, whether you're practicing as a lawyer, how many hours you worked last week, and the type of organization that you're in, a large firm, the government, or whatever. Right. And what comes through in that model, the significant predictors are law school GPA. The higher your GPA in law school, no doubt, perhaps the better job that you got, the more higher paying job. Number of hours worked last week comes through, as one might imagine. Working in business or financial sector comes through, predicting salary. Working in a large private law firm comes through big time. But being male comes through too. So net of anything else, at least anything I could control for, right? Taking into account all these factors, there was still a statistically significant advantage, although when you take everything else into account, not an enormous one, but an advantage as big as law school GPA toward males. I can't explain that, whether it's some other variable that we just didn't take into account, but it is unexplained in this study and in many, many other studies that have found similar results. How satisfied are people with their careers, right? Well, you ask the question, how satisfied are you with your decision to become a lawyer? Right. Extremely satisfied, moderately, neither satisfied nor dissatisfied, moderately dissatisfied, extremely dissatisfied. And you can see extremely satisfied, men 42, women 45. And you can just see the numbers here, but there are a lot of numbers. If you collapse extremely satisfied and moderately satisfied, and collapse moderately dissatisfied and extremely dissatisfied, what you get is this. 81% of the men are extremely or moderately satisfied with having become a lawyer, 82% of the women. Between 5 and 8% of the people don't seem to know if they're satisfied or not, right? And between 11 and 12% of the people are dissatisfied with the decision to become a lawyer. If you ask people, the UVA School of Law prepared me well for my legal career. One strongly disagree. In the middle, neither disagree nor agree. And in the seven, strongly agree. You can see the numbers are there. Relatively few people disagree with that. Most people agree, and it differs a bit in their intensity. Again, if you collapse these three and these three, it's easier to understand. UVA Law School prepared me well for my career. 5% of the men and 11% of the women disagree with that. 88% of the men and 80% of the women agree. If the prestige associated with being a graduate of the UVA School of Law benefited my career, you can see that the great majority of people believe that to be the case. Women, 65% of women, strongly agree with that statement, 44% of men. Again, if you collapse 1, 2, and 3, and 4, 5, and 6, what you find is prestige of UVA benefited my career, 3 to 5% of the people disagree with that, 92% of the men and 96% of the women agree with that finding. The study I mentioned before, the After the JD study by Ronit Donavitzer and her colleagues, 5,000 people graduated from law school, they took many measures of job satisfaction of lawyers, did a factor analysis, and said there were three dimensions here, three kind of ways in which these different questions hang together. One of the dimensions they called the job setting dimension. They ask here, how satisfied are you with each of the following aspects of your current career? The level of responsibility you have, recognition you receive, control you have over the amount of work you do, control you have over how you do your work, your relationship with your colleagues, your job security, and the performance evaluation process. You rate each of those 1 highly dissatisfied, 4 neutral, 7 highly satisfied. And what you find here is two things. So 4 is the midpoint. 4 is neutral. You find on each of these dimensions, people on average are above 4, people are satisfied, and you find that the gender differences are very small throughout. So on average, people are satisfied with each of those dimensions of job setting. The second dimension, they called it work substance. The substantive, how satisfied are you with the substantive area of your work, the tasks you perform, the intellectual challenge of your work, and the opportunities you have for building skills? Here you find the same thing. The average score of the group is significantly above the midpoint. Most people are satisfied with that, and you find very small and inconsistent gender differences. The final factor they call the power track dimension, only 2 items, compensation, including salary, benefits, and bonus, and opportunities for advancement. Here you also find people above the midpoint. You do find here that women are slightly less satisfied than men with compensation, which is not a surprise given the slide we just showed, right? And to a lesser degree, women are slightly less satisfied with opportunities for advancement, but these differences are not statistically significant. Most people are above the midpoint. So are satisfied, right? If you collapse, you look just like at people who got a score of 5 or higher on the 7-point scale. So 5, 6, and 7 are above the midpoint. On the job setting dimension, 81% of both genders are satisfied. The substance of the work, 90% of the women are satisfied. 79% of the men are. And in terms of the power track, 70% of the men satisfied. 67% of the women. You do a regression model trying to predict. We chose just one of these dimensions, the job setting dimension, which, as you recall, has these kinds of factors in it: responsibility, recognition, control over the amount of work, how you do it, your relationships, job security, and how you're evaluated. And again, you include all these variables in this analysis, just like before: gender, admission index, explanatory style, GPA, health, whether you're married or partner, children, practicing as a lawyer, how much you worked, where you worked, and your annual compensation, your salary. What comes through for job satisfaction here is your compensation comes through. People feel better about their jobs when they're making more money. That's positive. But what also comes through is working in a large firm, and that's negative. So in terms of job satisfaction, people like making the money, but they don't like working in a large firm. And these are net of one another. These are independent effects. Right. Here are the organizational settings by job satisfaction. Here's a small private firm. Here's business. Here's federal, state, or local government, public interest, and large firms. private law firms, bringing up the rear. We did, the analysis was just looking at the whole sample. We did separate analyses by gender rate, which the problem is then the numbers go down, so it's the sample size was reduced. What you find when you do that is among women, job satisfaction is significantly positively affected by being married or partnered, and it's significantly negatively affected by having children at home. Together, that effect washes out. Among men, job satisfaction is not associated with being married or partnered or with having children at home. It just doesn't make any difference to men. Right. How satisfied, finally, are they with their lives more generally? To find it, we use the satisfaction with life scale developed by Edward Diener, a psychologist at the University of Illinois. This is the standard instrument in this area. This instrument has been used in hundreds of studies. It's been translated, I think, into 20 different languages. Five questions. In most ways, my life is close to my ideal. The conditions of my life are excellent. I'm satisfied with my life. So far, I've gotten the important things I want in life. If I could live my life over, I would change almost nothing. You score that 1, strongly disagree, 4, neutral, 7, strongly agree. So if you strongly disagree, you get a score of 5. If you strongly agree, you get a score of 7. I pause for a minute as you put yourself on that scale. Right. One of the graduates who wrote in was quite upset at this. He said, how could this be? Who could ever check off 7 to all of these questions? I said, well, that's kind of the point. If everybody could check off 7, it would be a terrible measure because everybody would be the same thing. What you got to do is distribute the population among a continuum. So you can score, again, up to 35 on this scale. Diener, when he did the study, having done these hundreds of studies, he put people's responses into 5 categories. Very highly satisfied, 30 to 35. Highly satisfied, 25 to 29. Average satisfaction, 20 to 24. Most people in most countries score above the midpoint on this scale. Most people think that they are not, that their lives are not neutral. Most people feel at least mildly satisfied with their lives. Slightly dissatisfied, 15 to 19. Dissatisfied, 10 to 14. Extremely dissatisfied, 5 to 9. If you look here, very highly satisfied, 33% of the men, 43% of the women. Highly satisfied, about 30. Average satisfaction between 17 and 19. And you see smaller numbers here. If you combine the 3 satisfied groups with the 3 dissatisfied groups, what you find is 83% of the men and 90% of the women are, on balance, to a greater or lesser extent, satisfied with their lives. 11% of the women and 17% of the men are at least slightly dissatisfied with their lives. Again, you do a multiple regression model trying to predict life satisfaction scores, looking at all the same variables that I looked at before. And again, in other analyses, we looked at other variables, and none of them came through. What you find when you do that, significant predictors, health. It's good to be healthy. That's not a big surprise, right? Being married or partnered is good for your life satisfaction. Being a practicing lawyer is good for satisfaction in life. Working in a hospital. That's big. That's bigger than being married. It's bigger than being healthy. Right. That is very big. Right. Here, if you look at it in terms of life satisfaction, the settings change a bit for life satisfaction. Federal, state, or local government is the highest now. Public interest, small private firm business, and in life satisfaction, more so than in job satisfaction. Large private firms are much lower than other groups. There are limitations of this research. I only studied one class, just the class of 1990. The numbers are not large enough to test for many effects, like to test for the effects by race. The only subgroup analysis we could do is by gender. Right. I only used one measure of life satisfaction, that Diener Life Satisfaction Scale. As I mentioned, there are others. We could do a study where we beat people all the time, I don't think that's going to work in these large private law firms, right? Or anywhere else. And the most important one, called the cohort effect. Legal practice may be different now than it was in 1990. To the extent that legal practice now is different, for example, the billable hours are up a lot for younger people, then to that extent, maybe the findings of people starting law practice now are not generalizable, or at least aren't perfectly generalizable to current practice, as was the case in 1990.
Right.
I, personally, having thought about this for longer than I'd care to admit, draw five bottom lines from here. One is our graduates take many, many career paths. No single setting accounts for the employment of more than a quarter of our graduates. Most, fully 85% of all graduates have changed jobs at least once, and half the people have changed jobs two or more times in their careers. One quarter of our graduates are currently working full-time, are not practicing as lawyers at all. So there are many, many different things that people do when they graduate from law school, at least when they graduate from this law school. Here are the quotes. I took three representative quotes from what people wrote at the end of their survey. Starting off at a large firm is a great way to develop as a lawyer. If you're willing to trade off some salary after getting a few years, there are some wonderful in-house opportunities in the nonprofit sector. Many will provide some of the most sophisticated, challenging, and satisfying law jobs around. I hope law school grads understand that the skills and knowledge they gain in law school can be applied to a lot more than the practice of law. I've combined my experience as an engineer, as a lawyer, and as a businessman to arrive at a satisfying career outside of a traditional legal career. I would tell current students to not be afraid to try unusual places or ways in which to practice law. I would never have imagined myself as a solo practitioner in a poor area of rural Virginia. But overall, I'm extremely satisfied with life and practice here. I can raise my show dogs, go to the office in shorts, and still face exciting challenges and intellectual stimulation. A happy camper. Right. Second finding, gender differences are pervasive. Women graduates are less likely than men to be employed full-time, 61 versus 99%. The gender difference in full-time employment is entirely accounted for by having children at home. It's rare you find an effect that big that is entirely accounted for by one variable. Even so, however, two-thirds of the women with two children at home are working full-time. Women working part-time work a median of 20 hours a week. Women earn significantly less than men, even controlling for type of job, number of hours worked, and many other factors. After years of practicing in private firms, I believe it's incredibly difficult to have a career and raise a family. Many women my age agree. The idea that we could have it all sounded great, but it doesn't really work out that way. If there was one phrase that occurred throughout these comments, it was the phrase, have it all. Law firms are very difficult places for women lawyers. Most of the partners are men who have wives who stay at home, and it creates a very difficult place to practice law in a sophisticated way while balancing this with family responsibilities. I find that most of my male partners do not see their children during the week. For me, that is not an option that I would ever exercise. On the other hand, to be successful, you have to accept that your career will consume a much greater percent of your life than most jobs. You have to have a good support system. Forget the idea that you can do it all superbly. My husband does all the cooking and is proud of my success. The more valuable you are, the more flexibility you will have to negotiate a work schedule that works for you. Fourth, large law firms are perhaps the problem for many lawyers. 58% of our graduates start off in large firms. Half of those people leave to go to a different type of employer. The half that remain in large firms have lower job and life satisfaction than other lawyers. And yet, only 20% of the graduates who remain in large firms are dissatisfied with their lives in general. That's actually pretty high. Life in a private law firm is very demanding. Unless you love it, there is a soul-sucking quality. I would not encourage my own children to go into law unless they love it. UVA law degree, education, training, good. Slavish compulsion to follow the crowd and work in as big a law firm as possible, bad. That is the Tonto School of Communication, I think. I found the practice of law, even practice at a large firm, to be far more satisfying and intellectually stimulating than I imagined it would be when I graduated. So there's a wide variety of views about this. Overall, job satisfaction is high. 81% are satisfied with the decision to become a lawyer. 85% are satisfied with how well UVA prepared them. 93% are satisfied with how UVA benefited their career. So it's interesting. We're slightly better on paper than we are in real life. Right, right. I feel that way about myself often, actually. So, right. 81% of the people score 5 or higher on a 7-point scale of job satisfaction. There is overall no significant gender difference in job satisfaction. Among people who've chosen a career as an attorney, I'm one of the luckiest people alive. The firm I found is fantastic. I'm paid extremely well, have significant control over what I do, and I work very reasonable hours. An old Greek definition of happiness is vital powers exercised along the lines of excellence in a life that affords them scope. This describes the joy I get from the practice of law as a partner in a 21st century law firm. As I say, different strokes for different folks. Morty Kaplan said it best when he said that while there may be too many lawyers, there are not enough Virginia lawyers. A career in law can be very rewarding and fulfilling. However, law firms need to make it a priority to improve the quality of life of their associates and their partners. Overall, life satisfaction is high. 86% of our graduates are at least satisfied with their lives. 68% are highly or very highly satisfied with their lives. There's no significant gender difference in life satisfaction. Law is extremely rewarding. The intellectual challenge is a reward in itself. My practice is a window into human nature. It's unseemly at times, but by comparison with other people, my life is wonderful. Private practice is not for everyone, and government practice provides a great opportunity for better work-life balance. I don't make as much money as my private practice peers, but I have a great quality of life with my family. I'm a partner at a mid-sized firm in a mid-sized town. I control my own practice. I have 4 kids, and I put them to sleep almost every night. I coach a soccer team and a baseball team. It's a great life. The person lives in Bedford Falls, I think. Right? You know? So, the question we began with, how full the glass? I think the only answer that I can give is about 86%. Thank you very much.
John, it was a great talk. Let me say before anyone gets out, there is a reception that will be opening momentarily in Kaplan Pavilion, wine, cheese, and so forth. Let's do 2 quick questions. I know there are many more than that. But let's do 2 questions before we move to the informal question here.
So you find a negative correlation to being on life satisfaction from being in a law firm?
Yes, a large law firm, right.
Exactly, right, it's just association. Could it be that the pessimistic people who did well in law school,
right,
are those who are doing well, they're going to big law firms?
Right.
And that's why we, so it's not that
right.
Big law firm makes you dissatisfied, the pessimistic go to big law firm.
Right, that could have been, but it wasn't. Right. We tested for the effect of pessimism in going to those firms, and it just does not. Once again, it doesn't work. It didn't work in 1990, and it doesn't work now. So I think that concept just was not as useful as I thought. But that was an excellent hypothesis, but it was only tested. Right.
Again, with the law right. firms, for the career satisfaction,
yes.
They had their negative impact. But then the type of organization to work for the most associated with satisfaction was the law firm.
Being a lawyer, definitely practicing as a lawyer was associated with having increased satisfaction.
But there was actually a slide where, right. The second slide in life satisfaction, mm-hmm. I thought law firm was at on the...
That was a large law firm.
Okay.
That was a large firm. People are satisfied in smaller firms.
Wasn't the law firm on the left in the highest?
No, in both sides, job satisfaction and life satisfaction, being a large firm, a firm with more than 100 lawyers, was negatively associated with satisfaction.
One more.
What?
John, I was struck by the numbers about job satisfaction broken down by gender, and I was a little surprised to see that women were somewhat more satisfied.
Right.
Was that number statistically significant, and if so, what do you think might account for that, given the other ways in which it seemed to be to cut the disadvantage?
Right. There were no statistically significant overall gender differences in job or in life satisfaction. The only significant interactions were women were job satisfaction were somewhat more likely to be satisfied if they were married or partnered and somewhat less likely to be satisfied if they have kids at home. There a number of other studies have found job satisfaction. No one has before this study has looked at life satisfaction, have found the genders to be equivalent in job satisfaction and have puzzled at that. Given differences in mean salary, you'd wonder why are women so satisfied? They should be less satisfied than they are, right? And nobody's managed to explain that either, but you do find no gender differences in satisfaction at all, despite differences in average salary.
John, thank you very much, and thank you for coming. Please join us at Capital Reserve.
Right, thank you.